Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Kirk Dieter, and he'll be answering your most important questions on tips and tricks that will make you a better fly fisher. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Kirk a question, just go to our webpage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box there to send us your question. We'll receive your questions immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Kirk Dieter about tips and tricks that will make you a better fly fisher. Our approach is simple, education. Fly Fusion is unique when it comes to fly fishing magazines. It is one of only a few magazines in North America that focuses on instruction and education. In Fly Fusion, we've covered subjects like short line nymphing, tactics for tough days, stillwater fly patterns, dry fly fishing for fussy trout, and a host of other interesting and educational topics. Visit our website today at www.flyfusionmag.com. That's flyfusionmag.com. And start your subscription to Fly Fusion today so that you can learn all you need to know about fly fishing. Before we introduce Kirk, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away. And on our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have 2 chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. And in that section, just click on the link that says click here to register for our drawing. And click on that link, fill out the form, and then we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Kirk's book, A Little Red Book of Fly Fishing, courtesy of Kirk Dieter and Skyhorse Publishing. So here's how you can win Kirk's book. You must be the first person to answer the question that we ask at the end of the show. And the question is going to be about something that Kirk and I talk about during the show. Just submit your answer along with your name, your location, and your text box on our homepage. And the first person that answers it correctly with the proper information will win Kirk's book. So use your best typing skills and listen carefully during the show. But tonight our guest is Kirk Dieter. And Kirk is an editor-at-large for Field & Stream and host of the magazine's Fly Talk blog at fieldandstream.com. He's known for his offbeat story angles from chasing Mako sharks with flies to Dorado fishing in the Bolivian jungle to scuba diving, also known as going deep with trout, bass, walleye, and pike. His latest book, The Little Red Book of Fly Fishing, was co-authored with the late Charlie Myers, a longtime outdoors editor for the Denver Post. Well, Kirk, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's going to be fun. We've got all kinds of questions from our audience tonight, as usual. Okay, so we've got some questions from the audience, and then we've got some questions we've mixed in here from your book. Because that's really what it's all about, your book, right? Why don't you tell us the premise that your book was written on with Charlie? And that'll kind of give us a picture, I think, of where we're going with this tonight.
Sure. As writers, Charlie and I get to travel and fish with a lot of people. And Charlie was kind enough to take me under his wing, and he served as a mentor for me. And we were traveling on a trip to Wyoming to cover me for Field & Stream and him for the Denver Post, a story on oil and gas drilling in western Wyoming. And on that long drive, we just decided, you know, what would be great is to write a book where we empty out our notebooks, give the tips and tricks that demystify some of the things in fly fishing. I think one of the frustrations for me has always been that I've run into a lot of people who think, man, I'd love to fly fish, but I'm just not sure I can handle that learning curve. And so Charlie and I decided to make our book simple tips and tricks that demystify and simplify and make the learning curve as short as it can possibly be. And that's what we did with The Little Red Book. And sadly, Charlie passed away right before we published the book, but he got to see the final manuscript. And I think it was a neat culmination to his long, long career, because Charlie had always been about making things accessible and easy to understand, and that's what he was known for.
Great, great. Yeah, it's kind of part of his legacy now to have this book published after he passed, so that's great. That's great. Well, what we're going to do tonight is we're going to break our show down into basically the same sections you broke the book down into, and then we can work from there. And the sections of the book, you had part one was the cast, part two was presentation, part three is reading water, and then part four, bugs, and then five, miscellaneous. So, and what do we have? We've got 250 tips in this book, it looks like.
Exactly, 250 tips. And then the idea, like you said, is if we break fly fishing into the four areas that matter most, if we can figure out the cast, how to make the cast, decide what we're going to tie on the line at the end of the cast, make sure that when that fly hits the water, it's presented in a way that fish want to eat it, and then, of course, reading the water and knowing where to put that cast in the first place. Those are the four key areas, and then we had a miscellaneous grab bag at the end.
Sure. Well, let's start with the cast, then, and try to hit a few of the things that I'm pulling these out of the book and things that people want to know all the time and maybe get misinformation on and so forth. But one of them was, and I'm sure a lot of these just stemmed from questions that you guys were asked over the years as well or experienced. What is proper grip for holding the rod when you're casting it?
You know, it depends on the person, but one thing, I personally like to have my thumb on the top of the grip. I think it's important to have a finger on the top of the grip. Lee Wolf used to put his index finger on the top of the grip, running, you know, across the top of the cork and pointing down the end of the rod to where you want the cast to land. It's important to have that strong digit on top of the cork because that keeps your wrist from oversnapping, number one. And number two, instinctively, it's going to help you point and direct the cast in a better way.
So it's kind of a matter of preference, but you're leaning towards the thumb on the top, right?
I personally like the thumb on the top, but sometimes when I'm with somebody and they're not quite feeling the cast, one of the first switches that I'll make is to have them try it with the index finger on the top. If you point to your index finger, that helps a lot of people straighten things out, and then they can go back to the thumb if that's more comfortable for them.
Okay. The old 10 o'clock, 2 o'clock position. So this has been around since I was a kid, I know. And what's the real story on that? Is that really a good way to teach people, or is there some other way that's better?
Well, the old clock face, the 10 and 2 o'clock position, is right on paper. But inevitably, in my experience, when you get on the river and you say, okay, now you cast forward at 10 o'clock and you go, your back cast ends at 2 o'clock, and people do that, and they're at 3 or 4 o'clock. And that's the number one common mistake for beginners is that they overgo on the back cast. So what I tell people is, let's switch that from 10 o'clock and 2 o'clock and make it 9 o'clock and 1 o'clock. I'd rather have you stop high, air short, than go too far back. Because you can't load a rod when your rod tip is horizontal to the ground or the river pointed directly behind you.
Okay, so another thing is a question that comes up, and I know we all struggle with this, but what are some tips around effectively casting when you're in heavy winds? And we experience that for sure in the Rockies, but also down in the salt as well.
We experience that everywhere. And, you know, I was just in Kentucky last week talking to the Bluegrass chapter at Trout Unlimited, and we had a little breeze, and everyone came around. We did a casting demonstration on the pond, and number one question, how can I manage this wind? And my answer is simply, and this came from Chuck Neiser down in Texas, one of the windiest places I fished. And he says, you got to make friends with the wind. Realize, first off, that if you have a headwind pointing right in your face, a lot of people will let that intimidate them, but that's actually a good thing because, you know what, you drive your power and you load your rod and all the energy that happens that makes a good cast possible happens on your back cast. And so that's actually wind-aided when the wind's in your face. So another way of describing it is if you let that go and power your cast and then drive forward through the wind, but don't oversnap the rod at that point. Your power's on your way back and a smooth stroke forward, trusting the physics of the whole cast. And the graphite in the rod and the weight in the line will all do their job if you just let them do so. One other trip for casting in the wind, when it's in your face especially, is going back to that clock face and the 10 and the 2, really want to exaggerate the 1 o'clock or even 12 o'clock and finish lower. So you're moving that plane instead of up above your head back and forth, it becomes lifting up, loading the rod up high, and then driving it down toward the water when you make your finish on your cast.
So are you trying to, does it help to try to kind of, I mean, the closer you are to the water, is there less wind, less friction?
Well, it's kind of like the old golf analogy where you, when you have windy conditions, you'll tee the ball a little bit lower and you want to drive it with a lower trajectory down the fairway. Same thing is true when you're fly casting. If you have the really windy conditions, especially swirling winds, and your line's up high, that can be a challenge. Another thing you can do is, and I've done this a lot, is I'll even drop my cast to horizontal in the wind. So I'll be casting almost sidearm, just to keep that lower profile and to keep that wind from grabbing it up high above my head.
And, of course, you know, when you're fishing, kind of exasperates the matter if you're using, like, big bass bugs or big saltwater flies because you got more wind resistance, too, just, you know, in the air, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And when you have those big flies, another good wind trick, say you're a right-handed caster and the wind is coming from your right side. The danger there is that as you make the cast, the wind will blow one of those big bugs right into your head. In that case, I'll hold the reel and the reel seat and the cork in my hand right where it normally would be, but I'm going to tilt that rod at a 45-degree angle so that the tip of the rod is actually now over my left shoulder, and I'm moving that line back and forth downwind from my head. So tilting the rod to a 45-degree angle as you're making that cast from the right side with a right-hand wind will help you avoid the problem of getting banged in the head by your own flies.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's serious stuff with those big odd hooks. And that,
I pierced my ears several times unintentionally.
I noticed that. I saw you walking around down there in Pine the other day with something hanging off your ear. I couldn't
figure out what rock thing.
So how do we avoid wind knots?
Well, there's no such thing as a wind knot.
Oh.
No, sir. That's a euphemism that we've given ourselves to...
Or when we screw up.
explain a bad cast. Casting knots.
Yeah.
So,
So what do we call it? What are wind knots that we call wind knots that aren't
They're casting knots. They're okay. Bad cast knots.
Okay.
You know, the sooner we face up to that fact, the better off we're all going to be. But you know what? It's an inevitability. I mean, I tangled up last Thursday when I was out fishing. If you don't tangle up once in a while, you're not trying hard enough. You're not casting hard enough. You're not focused on the things in front. I mean, that's just an occupational hazard that's going to happen. What will prevent it from happening so much that you're not able to enjoy the fishing is simply slowing down and measuring and waiting for your cast. You know, I think that's a good lesson in all of fishing. If more people just slowed down and realized that their cast percentage of hooking up on a fish is going to go down with every cast that they make, fewer, more deliberate, better casts yield not only more hookups, but it will also avoid frustration.
Yeah. Yeah, good point. Regarding that, I know I always tend to have more problems when I've got, you know, a tandem rig on or something like that. And, of course, weights even compound the issue more. Any tips on casting, you know, a tandem rig, clearing that more easily?
Well, for anyone who – I grew up in Big Ten football country, and Woody Hayes was one of the coaches who's credited with saying that if you put the ball in the air, three things can happen and two of them are bad. And I think the same is true with fly casting. If you spend a lot of time casting up over your head, especially with a weighted nymph rig, two of the three things that can happen are bad. One of them is you'll spook fish, and two of them is you'll tangle yourself up. So I like to let the water and the current load the rod. If you just simply make more time roll casting or letting the rod or the line go taut with the current below the run, and then just simply lift it and point where you want it to go and drive the cast down, you'll avoid 90% of the tangles that way.
So, yeah, so just spend less time in the air. Don't be back casting five or six times to make that cast. You know, hopefully be just once. Yeah.
Exactly. You know, we talk about one of the misnomers with fly fishing. We talk about casting as like the point of entry to this sport. And don't get me wrong, casting is remarkably important in saltwater fly fishing. But of all the sections in the book, And of all the sections that you can talk about in fly fishing, for trout, casting to me is the very least important thing. It's impressive for your friends, it's fun to do, but when I'm out functionally fishing on a river myself, I'm doing 90% of my casts as roll casts. And I think that's a good lesson for a lot of people to follow. Now, don't get worried about your cast. Don't try to make an 80-foot hero cast. If you make an 80-foot cast in a river, you've just made one nice cast, but you've caused yourself like 10 to 15 mistakes to get there.
Yeah.
So I think it's more important to make a 20 or a 30-foot cast that's on time, on target, and more importantly, that the float that you get with your fly after the fly hits the water is good. You know, okay. I'm more concerned about the 5 seconds after a fly hits the water than I am about the 5 seconds before a fly hits the water.
And then, too, if you do a really long cast on any significant river and you hook up, you've just created more problems for yourself because you've got maybe one or two or three currents in between you that you've got to bring a fish back through, which isn't good for you or the fish. So
that's exactly right.
Yeah, yeah.
And not to criticize, they have these casting competitions, which are fun and is neat, and it gets people to cast better. And a good cast is never going to hurt you. But for anyone who says to me, you know, I went out on the river and I made this 80-foot cast at the trout, and I'm thinking in my head, man, what other mistakes did you make to get yourself in that position?
And how many fish did you catch?
That's right. You're not bragging to me at that point. That's not a good thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's talk about some of the things that spook fish. Some people think it's the line in the air, the shadow, the splash, you know, the landing of the line.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't you do some underwater research on this?
I did.
Yeah.
Some of the people who read Field and Stream will remember the Going Deep stories where I went down with scuba gear, and I watched trout eat nymphs specifically, and it was amazing. I could get to within arm's reach of the fish and watch them eat. They weren't bothered by me because they'd never seen a big rubber-suited bubble-blowing blob before. I wasn't a typical predator. They didn't have a fear response. But the number one thing that freaked the fish out, without question, was shadows from above. So a heron would fly over the river, or a hawk would fly over the river, or the angler would make too many false casts over the run. And they all had the same effect. The moving shadows, the movement, the flashes up above the fish is what scared them the most, bar none.
And then did you notice, as far as the splash of the line itself, did that seem to bother them?
You know, the splash, I think, is definitely important. We talk about lining fish.
Right.
You know, people ask me all the time, does the color of my fly line matter? And my answer there is that the color of your fly line matters for you. If you can see the behavior of your fly line better with a bright orange fly line, great, because the fly line color is for you. It's not for the fish. Because if you're throwing that line and it makes a splash over top of the fish, you're going to spook the fish, whether it's bright orange or camouflage gray line or whatever. So they make the leader 9 foot to 12 foot long for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
And so the ideal cast is definitely the one where the line lands behind the fish and the fly lands in front of the fish and the leader is the connection in between. A soft-landed leader doesn't spook the fish at all.
Right, right. Yeah, okay, good. Yeah, another thing, I don't know, I got it from somebody else. This is my line, but I used to tell my son, if you can see the color of the fly fisher's line upstream from you, then you're too close.
Yeah.
Move on down, you know. Some of these crowded rivers, that's kind of a, you know, it was just something I taught him to, hey, give everybody some room, you know. So that's where color of line comes important.
That's a great example and a great lesson, too.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, another one in the casting area. You know, what are some of the most common casting errors people make that you see on the river?
Well, we touched on one just a second ago, but it's worth repeating. Too many false casts. Certainly too many false casts directly over the run. If you need the false casts to let line out, make them behind your target and then adjust for your final delivery cast to put that on the target. If you're waving 8 or 9 false casts over the fish, you're really diminishing your chances. So that's number one. Number two, in the mechanics of the cast, I think a lot of people will over-snap the rod or overpower it. They'll want to oomph going forward, and what that will cause is the tailing loop. And the tailing loop is the slice. To a fly fisherman, the tailing loop is what a golfer slice is, and it's a very common error. It's often caused by overpowering. And if you just let the swing happen and you let the cast happen, that's typically the way to take that tailing loop problem away.
Okay. Now, time to take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk with Kirk Dieter more about tips and tricks that will make you a better fly fisher. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 25 years, with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you a straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging on to their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Kirk Dieter about tips and tricks that will make you a better fly fisher. If you'd like to ask Kirk a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Kirk, we always ask our guests what's going on in their fly fishing world, so what is going on in your fly fishing world?
Well, actually, this time of year is kind of a welcome relief for me. Typically on the road with Field & Stream and covering stories from April until the end of October. And I just got back from my last trip. I was in Kentucky talking to the Trout Unlimited chapter there. And I'm home for a while, at least for the next few months. And not that I'm going to be not working, unfortunately. This is the season when I actually write the stories that will appear in next year's Field & Streams. So I'm right now working on March stories, and then we'll roll into April, May, June, July, like that. Typically, the wintertime is the writing season, and then the summer is being out on the road and gathering the fodder for the next season.
So that's where the really hard work comes into play, right, Kirk?
That's right.
That being on the road.
That road.
Having to fish in exotic places. And,
I know. Yeah. I know. No, actually, the hard stuff is what when I'm cold and wondering about exotic places and remembering the good summer months. And my eyes are bleary, and I'm behind a computer, and I'm banging out.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, just giving you a hard time, you know. But it is hard work.
Somebody's got to do it, yeah.
Yeah. The grass always looks greener on the other side of the hill, but there's plenty of work to be done there, even though you do get to have some good experiences, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the grass is plenty green. I have a pretty good job. I'm not going to lie to you. It's a great job.
So is there any websites or anything that you want to tell folks about where they can keep track of what you're doing or your articles? Or?
Sure. You know, the best way to keep hold of or track of me is going to fieldandstream.com.
Okay.
And pretty much every day or every other day, you'll see a post on Fly Talk, and it'll be either me or Tim Romano talking about it. We've got some interesting stuff slated. Having come off the road, we've got a lot of good product stuff coming up and some issues-related things happening, so it's going to be worth checking out fieldandstream.com and Fly Talk in the next month or two.
Great.
And then if anyone wants one of my books for a gift or something like that, there's a little website called redbookflyfishing.com, and you can buy a book there and request if you want to make it out to your mom or whatever, and I'll sign it and we'll send it and customize it that way. So,
okay, what is that website address again?
It's redbookflyfishing.com.
Okay, redbookflyfishing.com. Thanks. Yeah, and that's a great book, everybody. And, of course, we're going to be giving one away tonight. So somebody's going to be lucky tonight. Anyway, let's get back to some of these questions and see what we've got here. Let's talk about presentation here. And we got some questions in from our audience on presentation. So let's kind of march through these and see what we've got. First one is from Randy in Tennessee. He says, "Hi, Kirk. This year when I gotten a chance to go fishing, the river has been low, gin clear, and it has been a pretty day out, clear skies. I know these are tough conditions to fish. What tactics or strategy do you suggest I use in those conditions when I only have time to fish a day like that? The fish ignore everything I try on these rivers. They laugh at me, too." So what suggestions do you have for Randy? We've all experienced those beautiful down days, so to speak.
Right? Yeah, those are the most comfortable days and the most difficult days at the same time. And number one factor, he mentions it in the question, is the sunshine. And going back to the issue of shadow spooking fish, on a sunny day, I'm going to approach the river with the same concern and diligence as I would if I were going to photograph the river. So I spend a lot of time away from the banks, and I spend a lot of time watching where my shadow goes on the water and watching where my casting shadow goes. I think that's 50% of the issue. A lot of times also on these sunny days, I'll fish from upstream down and present my dry flies across the bank, across the current, against the far bank, and let it come down. Now, on those sunny days, typically those fish are going to want to be really tight to the banks as well. So, major problem that a lot of us anglers have is we bull right into the run, and we get all excited to go fishing, and we end up stepping on the fish, you know, almost literally. We spook them out that way. So, for sunny days, especially low profile, slow approach, creep up on them, and remember to cast and fish pretty tight to the bank.
Do the fish seek more cover then on the sunny days? Are they looking to, when you said they're uptight to the bank, I assume they're trying to get out of that exposure to sunlight, which kind of helps the predators find them too, I suppose.
Exactly. Those are the days when you're going to find a big brown trout tucked under a cut bank, a grassy cut bank, and that's a great day to swing or slip a grasshopper down that bank, usually from an upstream cast. And cast across, throw a mend in your line, and just let it drift right down under the bank. Really slow down the approach and work tight to the bank, and that's probably going to fix the problem.
Okay, and here's a question from James in New York. He wants to know, what do you think are the best flies to use during fall conditions, and do you continue to fish during the winter in cold climates?
I do. Typically, fall time is a great streamer time for me. I love to do streamer fishing this time of year, get some real predatory responses out of the brown trout. Obviously, in some of the Great Lakes areas, like around New York, Michigan, Ohio, et cetera, with the steelhead moving up into the rivers. Love to throw big black leeches and woolly buggers that time of year. Other places, October caddis is a fantastic hatch. It's worth paying attention to. I also think, to answer the other part of the question, do I fish in the winter? Heck yeah, I fish in the winter. It becomes more midge-dominated where I live in Colorado, but we just fish smaller patterns like zebra midges and black beauties and RS2s and small mayflies and midges, and that tends to get the trick done. A lot of it depends on the water temperatures, and so if you can find a tailwater where the water temperature is fairly consistent, even though the air temperature might be 30 degrees, the water temperature might stay 38 or 40 degrees. And so those typically end up being the best fisheries in the wintertime.
Okay. Question from Matt in Maryland. It says, could you describe some features which suggest when to try emergers versus nymphs or dries? Very good question. And additionally, he says, does current slash water type have much influence in this, other than that it may be harder to follow the midges in really fast water? But that's a good question.
That is a great question, and it's a difficult answer. There's a few parts to it. Number one thing that will clue me in on emergers is the fish behavior. So if I'm watching a run, and you'll notice in my answers this consistent pattern here, you're going to hear me talk about watching a run over and over and over again. I'll spend more time watching a run than bulling in and fishing it, and that's really, really important to do. But if I'm watching a run and I see action, waves, ripples, maybe even fins, but I'm really not seeing the mouths or the snouts of the fish come out, that's a telltale right away that they're eating emergers. I'm also, his point about fast water and fishing emergers in fast water is a really good one, and that's true. The same is almost true, also true for extremely slow water. So you really want to find that kind of water where it's moving a couple feet per second or less, and if you get into the tail outs of the runs, that's where I find the best emerger action happens.
I know often when I'm, especially at night when it's hard to see sometimes, you know, the sun's gone down and you're fishing those low light levels, it's hard to see the rises and what's going on there. But I've, you know, many times put on a dry and then an emerger, you know, just hanging off the back end of that and a tandem rig. And many times I get fish on both.
Yeah. I think probably the most effective fly in the world, or at least where I live, and is the bar emerger. and the Bari merger is specifically designed for the reason that you just explained. If you fish a dry fly and you trail a small emergent nymph, it can be like a pale morning dun pattern or a betas pattern or whatever, and let it ride, either in the film or just below the film. Sometimes you'll wait it all the way down. But that emergent, you know, whenever the flies or the fish are on the dries, they're probably also on the emergers as well. So a tandem rig with a dry emerger is never a bad idea.
Yeah. I know the lake up here by me that I fish regularly, some nights that's all you can see. It's like sharks out there. All you can see is fins. You know
that's
what I mean?
Right.
They're
right.
Just cruising around, and these fins are sticking out all over the place. No mouths, just fins.
Yeah.
So you know what they're doing then. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Sharon up in Nova Scotia, Canada, asks, "Is our water in our area is mostly tea-colored from the maple leaves. Streams I'm asking about for trout fishing are boggy with thick brush along the sides. The overhangs seem like they would hide a lot. Most people do not fish these streams for that reason. What would be the best type of fly in presentation to get it over and under without getting tangled up or snagged on the bottom? I'll take care of getting to the water." Cheers,
okay.
Sharon.
Okay. Where I'm originally from in Michigan is a lot like that as well. We have boggy, tea-colored water on the Baldwin River, and then a lot of stumps and deadfall around the water when we fish it. The instinct is to, the way that a lot of us are taught is to fish dry flies upstream. I found trying to land a dry fly around the deadfall upstream and then having it float back on the line that the trout want it going to eat it is, you know, 100 times harder than fishing from upstream down. So my answer to her would be to set the fly in the run with a downstream cast and then feed line slack down so that it allows that fly to drift in those tight pockets under the cover, and you'll be surprised how many fish you pick up that way.
Ah, good tip. So let the river kind of do the work for you.
And whenever you can let the river do the work, it's always a good idea.
Yeah. Great tip. We got a question on the Internet from Ken in Pennsylvania, and he asked, and we just talked about this in one respect, but he asked about whether you recommend fishing multiple fly rigs.
It depends. You know, it depends on your preferences and if you're comfortable doing that. Personally, I fish two flies 95% of the time. When I was down under the water with the scuba gear, I did notice that the fish would, if you used an attractor fly, like a big, bright, hot pink San Juan worm, or a large prince nymph, for example, and then you trailed a second fly on the same rig, you know, 18 inches away from that first fly. If I hadn't seen it myself, I wouldn't really have believed the theory, but I saw it play out over and over and over again, where the fish did indeed at least look and turn on the one fly, maybe not eat it, but they ate the second fly. And I don't think that they'd have eaten the second fly had there not been the attention getter on the front side. So same with the dry fly rigs. I often will fish, my eyes are going, I'm in my mid-40s, I can't see as far as I used to, and so I'll put a large attractor dry fly that I can see, and then we'll trail a smaller dry fly behind it, and anything that splashes around the fly that I'm able to see, I assume that maybe that the fish had eaten the other fly. So, yeah, I think that for various reasons, using a tandem rig is usually a good idea, but you know, if it's something that bothers you, or if you're dialed in on the exact hatch, and you've got the bug, the money bug going, you know, no need to overcomplicate things.
Yeah. Here's another question off the Internet. Mark in Deer Park, Texas says, I'm a novice fly fisher, just learning. I find myself in a stream, say, 50 to 60 feet across, and I like to work my way toward the middle of the stream so that I can work both sides of the stream with my 20 to 30-foot cast. It always seems like the fish are rising just outside my casting range. Would it be better to try to wade a little closer to where I see fish rising as opposed to stretching out my casts a few feet further? I'm concerned with the noise of wading versus pushing a longer cast out there. Your thoughts? He's got a couple of things going on here.
He's got a couple of things. My first thing is be careful not to wade out in the middle of the river if you're going to wade through fish to get to fish. If you're following my logic there, you know, the fish are going to hang on both sides of the river, usually closer to the bank. So I would focus on runs that are close to the bank, even if I sacrifice one side of the river. Or I'll fish one side of the river thoroughly, And then I'll find a good spot to cross, and I'll go clean up on the other side of the river. But if you're ping-ponging back and forth, that's probably spooking fish, and that's probably what's driving them just out of your casting range.
Kirk, the fish are always on the other side of the river.
The fish are always on the other side of the river, for the reason I just explained.
Yeah, because you put them there.
You put them there.
I mean, it always seems that way, doesn't it? Though? I mean, yeah. You can see this monster fish rising on the other side, you know.
Exactly. Well, to the other part of his really good question, though, and another thing that does spook the fish quite a bit is, apart from the shadows, I found when I was diving, if I would make noise, my tank would bang against a rock. Noise does travel faster in water, and it does irritate the fish. So if you can wade quietly and get closer to your target and make a shorter cast, that's optimal. If you know, I would actually choose wading closer and making a more effective cast as option two. And then option three would be to hold back and make a longer cast.
Okay. Now, the thing kind of came to mind here as you were talking about your underwater observations. Once you see the trout spook, for whatever reason, that would have been noise or shadow or whatever, how long does it usually take for them to get back into a feeding pattern?
Depends on where you are and how much food is really coming down the river. So if they're on bugs and it's a smorgasbord happening, you'd be surprised how quickly they come back. I'm talking 30 seconds. And in fact, in areas where we've got tubers going down the rivers and kayakers going down, and the fishermen get all frustrated because the tube or the kayak goes right over the run, you know what? That might cost you about a minute. In my experience, the deck resets itself a lot quicker than we anglers like to think it does.
Okay.
In some areas, if you're on a gin clear spring creek and something crazy floats over the, that's going to screw things up for quite a while. But when you've got current and lots of action going on, things tend to reset pretty quick.
That actually it's just kind of common sense, I would think, because those fish can't just go down for 3 hours and wait and then come back out again and feed for 30 seconds and then wait 3 hours, is starved to death.
Right. It's a risk-reward scenario.
Yeah.
As soon as the risk is gone, they're back on the reward.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we need to take another quick break. When we come back, we'll talk with Kirk more about tips and tricks that'll make you a better fly fisher. Captain Bob Jaspers of Flats Time Charters will introduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon, Indian River, and No Motor Zone of the Banana River on the east coast of Central Florida. Only a short drive from Orlando, you can sight fish for big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum, as well as seasonal snook and tarpon. Captain Bob is a lifetime resident of the area, and it shows in his knowledge of the local fish, flora, and fauna. Call Flats Time Charters now and arrange your next memorable adventure. You can reach Captain Bob Jaspers at 321-631-4051. That's 321-631-4051, or go to his website at flatstime.com. That's FLTSTIME.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Kirk Dieter about tips and tricks that will make you a better fly fisher. If you'd like to ask Kirk a question, just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Kirk, let's see here. We've got lots of questions on presentation. That seems to be a biggie. Got David in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He says, Kirk, I wish... A fish is a small river that averages about 127 CFS on average, and a larger river, the Muskegon, which has an average flow of 1,150 CFS. What advice do you have to give to get my nymph streamer down? There are often these troughs where the fish lie. So I guess mainly he's asking, how do I get deep on these heavy runs?
Great question, and it's also a great area. It's, like I said, it's where I did my growing up fishing up in that part of Michigan. It's really challenging because, as he says, the depth changes quite a bit, and the fish will hold in those troughs. I've found that I'll change my fly only once to every five times I'm going to change my weight. Weight is the most critical adjustment. So tinker with your weight five times before you even think about messing with the fly. And to get the right weight, I've started using this stuff called Mojo Mud, which is it's a tungsten, viral-safe putty that you can form on the cone of a streamer fly, or you can put a little regular split shot on a nymph rig and then form this Mojo Mud around it and then add and subtract to the equation as you need to adjust to the runs. If you Google Mojo Mud, you'll find it's just starting to take off. It's a pretty new product, but, I mean, I've not found anything that's as malleable and works as well for shaping and then sets up in a river when it gets cool and lasts as well as this stuff does.
Yeah, I think that stuff's made in my town up here in Bailey.
It's made in Bailey, Colorado, yeah. Don Perrozolo.
Yeah. That might be the only industry in Bailey.
That is the classic cottage industry. But you know what?
Yeah.
John's a good friend of mine, and so I'm not afraid to admit that I'm plugging my friend, but I wouldn't do it if the product really,
yeah.
really wasn't that good.
Yeah, so I use that stuff too, and I like it as well. Easy to take on and off and make fine adjustments. You know,
and that's the name of the game. That's really key, especially up there in Michigan.
Yeah. Well, along with that, here's another question on weighting. Nathan in Chicago asks, when nymphing, I've seen people recommend placing the split shot above both flies of a two-flied rig and in between the flies. What do you do? Are there advantages and disadvantages to either method?
I've done both. My typical 95% of the time or more, I'm going to make a knot about a foot above my top fly and hang my weight above that knot so it won't slide down, and then trail the second fly below that. So 95% of the situations, I've got my weight above the flies as you hang the rod and the line in the air. It looks like it's above, but, you know, truthfully, when it's in the water, then that weight is bouncing along the bottom. And by not having the weight between the two flies, you're allowing them both to kind of float and trail more naturally as they drift downriver. And that seems to be what picks up the most fish for me.
Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of guys are just going away from weight altogether and just weighting their flies.
Yep. A lot of people are into the Czech nymph or Polish nymph situation where they've got heavily weighted flies and they cast upstream and let those flies fall straight to the bottom, and then actually they'll feel the resistance of the fish on the bite. That works great. It's very popular in Europe and elsewhere.
Yeah.
And it's catching on here, but I'm still a, you know, Colorado high stick nympher.
Yeah. Okay.
Hard to beat when that's on.
Yeah. Question came in on the internet. Ken in Athens, Texas, says, you talk about the length of your leader and tippet being important, but what about the size? I now see 8X tippet material in Fly Shop. Is this light tippet really necessary or helpful?
A heretic in many respects, and so the tippet sellers are going to be really mad at me for saying this, but I won't fish anything less than 5X, personally.
Mm.
There's nothing that I found that you can't accomplish with adjusting your drift and your presentation that, you know, if switching over to 7X and making a crummy drift is not going to solve the problem as well as using 4X and making a great drift. And I'd rather encourage people to focus on the drift and the presentation. I think a lot of that 7X, 8X stuff is for show. I know I've got friends, they swear by it, they're on these spring creeks, it's ultra technical, blah, 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 blah. But I've been fishing now for the last 3 years in a lot of places, in a lot of super clear water, and I won't fish anything less than 5X.
Yeah. And I guess, again, it's one of those things, too, is, okay, so you hook up, now what are you going to do with 7, 8X tippet?
Yeah, watch the fish go away. Yeah, exactly.
So
makes no sense.
Yeah, it's kind of tough to bring in a 20-inch fish on that kind of light tippet. Okay, we have a question here. Rob Ridgewood asks, can you tell us something about how to read what trout are feeding upon based upon their rise?
Sure. Again, sit for 10 minutes. If you found your spot where you want to fish, sit for 10 minutes and watch the river. And then if you're lucky and the fish are rising, try to determine exactly how they're rising. And I'll be a little bit more clear. And a splashy chase-type rise might indicate that they're eating a caddis fly. A real slow, methodical tipping up of the nose and slurping down is your classic mayfly eat. Maybe if you watch a fish follow a terrestrial down and then suddenly inhale it, we'll tell you that that's an ant or a beetle or a grasshopper. So watching the rise forms and learning what types of rings and splash patterns happen will tip you off so that you can figure out what kind of dry fly to use.
Yeah, to kind of bring up a point, it'd probably behoove us all to just go out there for a day and leave the pole in the car.
Yeah.
And just study.
Yeah.
I suppose a lot of guides have that, you know, I mean, that's
why
the advantage they have.
Exactly. Why do you think guides are good?
Yeah.
You know, half the time I'm watching. If I'm out on a guide trip and I've got a client and that client's casting, and I'm trying 90% of the time to slow that person down, make them watch. But while they're doing their thing, I'm watching the whole time. So of the 8 hours that we're out there, I'm watching the runs and the behavior of the fish 7 hours of the day. So you can learn a lot in that time. And I would encourage not just guides, but anyone to take some time, put the rod at the side, put it on the bank, watch the river and see what happens. You'll be surprised how quickly you absorb the lessons of the river.
Right, right. Yeah, I was just, you know, I was over here on the South Platte the other day with my son, and I was just kind of taking a break, you know, kind of had my rod under my arm and was just watching the water he was fishing, and then I was able to see two fish down over this bank, and I directed him to fish to those fish. But, you know, without stopping and just kind of watching, I wouldn't have seen those fish, you know. Too busy fishing to see fish, so to
speak.
That's right. You know what I mean?
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, here's another question. It says, when fishing dry flies on moving, broken water, should the leader and tippet be dressed with liquid floatant also, or should it normally only be applied to the fly? Also, should floatant be used on floating fly line that seems to be sinking some near the tip, or is this generally better to use only dressing sold for cleaning fly lines on a used line?
I'm not a big fan of greasing leaders. I'll do it in certain really, really delicate technical situations where you want to grease your leader or tip it down to a certain spot and then maybe gink or sink another part of it and just leave a little dimple so there's a transition and you're dropping a small midge or something. But when we're on broken water, or like he describes here, I'm just not a big fan of that. I use monofilament, I mean mono floats. So float the mono. If the tip of your fly line is getting old and it's starting to sink, I use that dressing, yeah, but I typically am not big on using silicone grease or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Question from Steve in Tennessee. He says, I'm fortunate enough to fish a lot of different streams and rivers across the U.S., which all possess the challenge to know when drifting nymphs, midges, or spinners, what is the best or fastest way to know exactly what depth to fish and how to find fish quickly? And he says, please don't say hire a guide.
I promise.
I know where he's at, though, on that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's the big secret, isn't it?
It is. The short, quick answer to that is I start from the bottom and come up. You know, so I want to feel bottom. I want to feel the split shot or the mojo mud or whatever I've got on there tapping along the rocks on the bottom. And then odds are you're probably going to get bit if you're just tapping. If you're hanging on, getting stuck, obviously you need to lighten up and readjust. But I think it's a lot easier and more productive to go from the bottom up than from the top trying to find the right weight and depth going down.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. And I was kind of, again, goes back to your underwater studying. Could you just kind of ballpark percentages of where fish are? You know, in a normal situation, let's not say there's a big hatch, you know, and they're all at the surface. But in a normal situation, I bet you there's a percentage that are near the top, in the middle, and at the bottom. Could you give any kind of a feel for that?
Yeah, that's right. And you're exactly right. It depends on what bug activity is happening. If there's a hatch and the bugs are emerging and floating toward the surface, that will lift the trout up as they eat those. But say there's nothing going on and you're prospecting for trout. You know, the fish that's glued to the bottom is probably a non-player. For whatever reason, they're just not in the game. They're not eating. The ones that are the players, in my experience, are the ones that are a foot or 2 feet above the bottom, which is exactly where you want, why you want your weight to be tapping on the rocks, because those nymphs that are dragging behind are going to naturally float up, and they'll be right in that zone about a foot or 2 feet above the bottom of the river.
Right. Yeah, that's kind of what I was figuring you were getting at. Is in general, they're probably more in that zone than any other zone, I would think.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, let's see here. We've got Les in Fielding, Utah. Says, will you discuss some advanced nymphing techniques, please? I shy away from subsurface river fishing. I think I'm addicted to surface fishing, stalking. I know how to nymph. I just don't do it often. Maybe I need more practice to become comfortable with it. What do you think? And are there others who are doing the same thing?
Yeah, you know, my answer is kind of twofold. Who doesn't like stalking fish and catching them on dry flies? That's great. And I say the more you can do that, fantastic. I mean, but that said, nymph fishing is three-dimensional fishing, and it's a good challenge, and it brings out the best in you. It helps you do a lot of thinking that will transpose back to more effective dry fly fishing. So I encourage everyone to try their hand at nymph fishing. As for an advanced technique, you know, straight up high stick nymphing with a strike indicator, effectively a bobber, is about as simple a drift as you can get. Once you've got the rig set up right, there's nothing super advanced about that. That's why guides do it with beginner clients all the time. If you want more advanced type nymph techniques, that's when you get back into the more traditional things like swinging, casting across downstream, making a big cast, mend in the line, letting the fly sink and swing it in front of a rock and then have them lift as if they were emerging bugs right in the strike zone. That would be an advanced technique. It's also one of the oldest techniques. Kind of a what goes around comes around answer there.
It's also, I think, important to study those, you say, old techniques, those standard techniques of presenting that fly, whether it's a hook cast or, you know, things like that. Because you had mentioned it earlier, it's, you know, getting that fly in the right position to the fish at the right depth. And that's what nymphing is all about, right?
Absolutely. And if you, going back to the scuba stuff, which was really enlightening, you'd be surprised how much stuff those fish eat. And you'd be surprised how often they eat the fly. A really, really good angler is going to miss 50% of the strikes. Okay, because the trout are in there and they're eating sticks and leaves and bugs and all sorts of stuff and inhaling and ejecting as quickly as you can imagine. And so as that fly drifts into their mouth, you know, even a good angler is going to miss it half the time when they recognize the fish recognizes that it's fake and spits it back out. So, mm-hmm. You know,
yeah, you made a good point there because they don't really know. I mean, to them, it just doesn't feel right, so it's a stick, you know,
yeah.
Or leaf or something.
And they do eat sticks and they inhale them and then they spit them out.
Yeah.
And so the answer in that regard is, you know, if you hit them in the head and it's right in their vicinity, right in the ballpark, you've solved 90% of the problem. That's a big part of it. Again, I'm kind of a heretic. I don't believe in 150 different fly patterns in my box. You know, I'll carry 10 different nymph patterns and hit them in the head with one and see if they'll eat that. And then mm-hmm. That'll solve the problem most of the time.
I'm going to jump to a question here just because it kind of fits in what we're talking about here. Jimmy in Visalia, California asks, he says, I'm missing way too many hookups. I think that I get my share of strikes, but my timing must be way off the mark for setting the hook. I've tried setting it as quick as I can, tried saying, God save the queen, then set it. Tried raising the tip, tried strip raise, all with no luck. I'm getting frustrated. Can you give me some tips?
Well, the number one thing, if I'm guessing here, but as a guess, I'd say, are you setting the hook downstream? Or are you lifting it straight up? Or are you setting upstream? You know, the fish is facing upstream, and the fly floats down to him, and the fish comes up to eat it. And then if you're pulling the fly back upstream, you're effectively pulling it out of his mouth.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, it's a common mistake that a lot of people make. You want to make sure that you set the hook downstream and pull the hook into the fish's mouth. I also like a low hook set. A lot of people like talk about keep the tip up and all that stuff. But a good low, firm hook set will solve that problem most of the time. I'm guessing here again, but the tempo of the set, and God Save the Queen is a really good one on certain dry fly situations to slow down, let the fish grab the fly like a grasshopper and take it down and then set the hook. Mm-hmm. They say God Save the Queen in New Zealand a lot. But, you know, answer the telephone is another thing I tell people. You know, fish goes, eats your fly, your motion from the cork to your, should be like from the casting position to your ear as if you're picking a telephone receiver up off the desk. Say hello, and that's about all you can
do. That's very good. Yeah, I'm just trying to do that here, you know, as you're describing it. And, yeah, that's not a fast motion usually.
That's right. Just answer the telephone. Say hello, and hopefully that'll solve Jimmy's problem.
Yeah. So would you say that most of us are too fast, and that's a more common problem than too slow?
Yes.
Yeah? Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
But, well, it depends. That's dry fly fishing, too fast and probably too slow on the nymph stuff. You know? Yeah. By the time a fish inhales it, right, and there's enough drag to slow down the weight, and then the strike indicator, if you're using a strike indicator, that's almost a full second, typically. When I was scuba diving, I would tease my friends and go out and grab the line every once in a while and pull it, you know, and I never got stuck in my fingers because they were so quick and stuck me. It took a long time for them to react to that.
Yeah, yeah. It seems like many of the people that are very good have a sixth sense about that, you know. I mean, I fish with guys that, for some reason, they just, you know, we can fish the same run and they'll hook up, you know, twice as many fish. And I swear it's a sixth sense of some sort.
Yeah. I think you're totally right.
You know, they're setting that hook when I would think nothing's happening, and they're hooking up, you know. So, like you said before, I think we miss way more than we know about, not knowing about the opportunity itself, so we don't try to set the hook.
That's
okay.
True.
Let's see here. We need to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll dig in a bit more, and we're just kind of started in on these questions, Kirk. There's a lot of things to think about. So when we come back, we'll talk with Kirk more about tips and tricks for being a better fly fisher. Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please tour their website at www.dryflies.com to view the fishing products and guide services they offer in Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. That's www.dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Kirk Dieter about tips and tricks that will make you a better fly fisher. If you'd like to ask Kirk a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box there to send us your question. We'll get the question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. So, Kirk, let's look back here on the Internet and see what we got. We got a few questions coming in here. Okay, this is kind of a general question, but Chris in Porterville, Michigan says, what is a decent setup or fly rig for fish that don't seem to be biting? That's a trick question.
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, because in my mind, it's maybe not so much the setup or rig as to, you know, knowing what's going on.
I would say that the rig is probably the least of your concerns.
Yeah.
It's more the approach and the waiting. And, you know, I'll give you a quick tip. I mean, one thing that we know is that fish see colors and that they're more receptive to the blue or violet side of the spectrum than they are to the red side of the spectrum. So when there's nothing really happening, that's why flies like purple princes work, purple leeches, purple woolly buggers. It's the same in saltwater, too. I mean, when the trolling is difficult, purple skirts work for tuna. And the bass guys use purple bugs a lot, you know, like soft plastics quite a bit in tough conditions. So if you're looking for an attractor bite, try purple.
Okay. And also, the tandem rig, as far as the setup goes, you know, that many times we use those tandem rigs for searching.
Sure.
Try to find depth and try to find what they're taking. So.
That's right. They call that one fly a stimulator for a reason.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's a great attractor fly.
Yeah. How many times have you gotten hits on the strike indicator?
Often. Often.
Has anybody tried to tie a strike indicator fly?
Yes, there is a strike indicator fly, actually. Yeah.
There is?
Yep. It's yarn with a hook. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you almost might as well put a hook in that thing.
Absolutely. I think Umpqua is making it.
You're serious?
No, I'm totally serious.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. I'll be darned. Yeah. I mean, because all of us have had that happen, I'm sure. Okay. Another person from Michigan here, Mark in Lansing. I live in Michigan and want to get in some casting practice during the winter. As a beginner, should I take casting lessons inside a school gym, or what would you suggest?
Absolutely. Short answer. I'll start to rapid fire some of these answers. But, yeah, I mean, anywhere you can cast if you want to hone. And inside a school gym is great because what we said earlier, you don't need to be outside where you can throw 80 feet of line, because if you throw 80 feet of line on the river, you've just made a big mistake. Go in that gym and learn how to throw 30 feet straight, and you're going to be just fine for the spring.
And I think just kudos to him for going and taking lessons.
You know, absolutely.
I mean, use that time to do that, because that'll pay off in the long run, no doubt.
Huge dividends, yeah.
Yeah. Ken Calhoun in Athens, Texas, says, when you are fishing a dry fly and the fish seem to be nudging it, your fly with their nose, but not actually taking the fly, what is going on there?
Typically, that's a refusal, and the fix for when you get refused, the fish comes up, looks at your fly, but says no. He's interested in the pattern, but not happy about the size, so size down. If you're fishing a size 16 blue-winged olive, change it to a size 18 blue-winged olive, and usually that'll fix that problem.
Oh, okay. Here's another one on the Internet. John in Rockland, Maine, asks, when fishing tandem rigs, do you use a traditional dropper, i.e. the tag end of a blood or surgeon's knot, or a dropper tied to the bend of the hook?
I've seen it both ways. I personally will tie a cinch knot on my finger and then attach that to the hook shank of the lead fly and then trail my second fly anything from 12 to 18 inches below the first fly.
Okay. And I'm just going to answer this for Dean, another one on the Internet, Westford, Massachusetts. He's asking about fishing for northern pike on the fly. Dean, I suggest you listen to, we've got a show with Barry Reynolds on pike on the fly and also one on muskies. Search our archives for those, and you'll get much more detailed information on bite tippet, shock tippet, all that kind of stuff. And check out our archives on that one. Okay, these people are just rolling them in here on the Internet. I'm going to get back to the ones that were sent in earlier in the past couple of days. We've got Dustin in Washington, and he fishes for native Columbia red bands, rainbows. He finds the most consistent techniques for him is to skate a stimulator across the surface, creating a nice pulsating V wake and left-to-right action. It doesn't seem to matter if it's upstream, downstream, or across. What is it about this presentation and fly combo that triggers fish? It's about as far away from the dead drift as possible, but it seems to work despite the weather and hatch conditions.
You know, I was fortunate I get to go down to Chile and Argentina and fish dry flies down there, and the skate is the trick. And I think it's just a matter of the fish and the environment. I know if you tried that deal on my home river, it would go over like a lead balloon. I think, though, it makes me want to go to his river in Washington and fish there because it sounds pretty exciting.
Yeah.
I think a natural instinct of a fish is to, you know, a lot of those terrestrial bugs are moving when they hit the water. And the less pressured places, like in Argentina or Chile, and perhaps his river is less pressured, fish are going to key on those natural type activities that, you know, wiggles and waffles and skates and all those things. And that's a really cool deal. I think that the reason that the dead drift is so important in other places is because fish see a lot of flies dragging unnaturally, and it, you know, the pressure factor is what causes them to gravitate toward the perfect dead drift.
Yeah, yeah. Michael in Monument, Colorado asks, when using a heavier nymph in a smaller, lighter fly setup, midge pupa, would you put the heavier nymph on the line first, or do you recommend putting the heavier fly at the end of your line?
I always put the heavier fly on first and trail the lighter fly behind it.
Okay. Can you tell us why?
Well, just to drop it down, again, I like the heavier, the closer connection to the weight with the heavy fly and the attractor fly, a little bit closer together. Gets the whole rig down and floating a little bit more naturally. I find if you have a big heavy fly and then a weight, and you've got this little bitty fly just kind of bobbing up and down in between the two.
Gives it more action, huh?
It's more action and less natural. So I like the big fly first.
Okay. Rob in Ridgewood asks, why tie tippet to a tapered leader?
If I don't need to.
Okay.
I'm fishing a 9-foot leader and that's enough. You know, usually my tippet is just lengthening my leader back out.
Right.
You know, if I think
or
I
to
need,
provide that knot to put a weight on.
If I need, exactly. If I need a knot there to go nymph fishing with, I'll lengthen. If I'm on a spring creek and I need 14 feet, I'll lengthen. But if I'm dry fly fishing with a grasshopper single fly, and 9 feet is plenty, that's what I'll use.
Okay. Let's talk about reading water here. Bill in Pennsylvania writes in, this is the worst time of year for fishing for me. Leaves are falling and it's getting colder and fish just aren't cooperating. What is your approach to a cool fall day when the temperature is in the low 50s when there are no hatches? How are we going to read the water and find the fish on those days?
We're going to fish tight to the bank, and we're going to streamer fish on that day. You know, we've got all sorts of garbage on top and probably in the water column. I want to show a fish that might be sluggish or getting sluggish a big T-bone that they can't refuse. Hmm. So
a big black leech or a white sculpin or a muddler minnow, whatever I can get down into the run, get a little action on, make them an offer they can't refuse. That's my approach when it's cold and leafy and all those things in Pennsylvania.
Seems like if you've got a lot of crap on the water like that, that might actually work to your advantage in fishing streamers, because maybe the fish will come out more because they're used to seeing a lot of stuff up there.
Exactly. They see all that stuff, and then all of a sudden, boom, here's this flashy white bait fish going by.
Yeah.
They're going to jump out and ambush that thing.
Yeah, they'll risk it then.
Absolutely.
Okay, we've got Adam in Sydney, Australia, and he says, "G'day, Kirk."
G'day.
When you are fishing unknown water and there's no visible hatch, do you have a favorite rig fly that you like to start with, or do you prefer to try and study the water more closely before you start?
That's a great question, and after my own heart. I study the water. I'll sit for up to a half an hour or longer and try to, I think it's the time invested is worth, time of observation is worth 10 times more than time in the river with trial and error. So, that said, if I've sat there and I've watched and I really don't have any clues, that's when I'm going to try things like stimulator flies or purple prince nymph or some of those tricks that we can get an attractor, the tandem rig where I've got a big attractor fly and a smaller morsel fly. Those are the dirty tricks I'll pull out when it's tough like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you keep coming back to that. Boy, all night long you keep saying, stop, study, look, stop, study, look. And I hope everybody's getting that because I know you feel that's the most important thing, being successful out there. So.
And you know what? It's not just me. It's Charlie Myers said it, and he was those editor for 3 years at the Denver Post. You can go to South America, and the guides will tell you that there. Up in Alaska, I mean, it never hurts to do that.
Right.
So I'm sorry if it's the same old beating the lesson, but if that's one thing that people walk away from tonight, having learned, that's probably the most important.
Yeah. No, and I'm not criticizing you at all for that. It's just because I do many times the same thing. You get so excited, and it's been, 2 weeks since you've been fishing, and you just want to get that line in the water,
Sure, it's interesting.
We all feel that way, Yeah, so, okay, we've got Martin in Lawrence, Kansas, says, what are the feeding patterns or times of day for different species and sizes of trout? He says, by the way, love your little red book, a great read and fishing resource. So,
well, thank you for that, Martin. And my answer is that, again, it's not to dodge the question, but it really depends on where you are. I'll give an example, kind of a generic example of brown trout. And I'll find that the bigger brown trout are really night feeders. So those are the big fish will come out and eat a mouse fly at 10 o'clock or midnight. And you might turn a big fish on a streamer in the morning, early morning, 6 a.m. And then toward the middle of the day, that's when you're probably going to catch smaller brown trout, but you'll probably pick up more in quantity if you throw a terrestrial, like an ant or a beetle or a grasshopper, in the prime months of summer. And then, of course, the evening hatch, if you can key on that, that's the wild card when anything goes. If it's on, it's on, and all fish will come out and experience that. But by and large, you'll find your biggest predatory fish are night feeders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. We did an interview with Bill Edrington. You probably know Bill, down on the Arkansas. And, we talked about that during his interview, and he says, hey, when people come down to the Arkansas, this is the Arkansas and Colorado, by the way, folks. He says, I recommend, hey, you drive over to the valley, go have a nice breakfast, have your eggs, your potatoes, your bacon, and, then wander out to the river about, 10:30 in the morning, and then fish till it's dark. He says, but you're wasting your time in the early morning getting up with the sun because most of the fish are inactive at that time. The water hasn't warmed up yet, and as the water warms up, then they become more active, and so why waste your time? So I think you got to know your area, too, right? I mean,
Sure. Where
you are in the world and what's going on. I remember one time, too, down in the San Juan River in New Mexico. We all figured, well, we're going to beat the guides out there, at the Texas Hole and get our boat in there before everybody else. So we went down real early, and we fished for a whole hour before the guides showed up, and it was lousy. And then as soon as the guides showed up, everything picked up.
Sure.
And then we realized it was too early.
Sure.
The fish just weren't active yet, So... Again, study and research.
Yep, and it depends, season by season.
Yeah. What time of year as well? Okay, we're closing in here on the end of the show. We've still got lots of questions. Let's see what we can get done. Oh, and again, seeing fish, you know, how can we see fish in the river? What are some of the dead giveaways that fish do that allow us to spot them?
Yeah, the trick to spotting fish is knowing where to look. So it's like Yogi Berra-ism. But if you look on those places where fish will hold, current seams, changes in structure where there's a depth drop-off, fast current meets slow current, or behind rocks, in front of rocks. When I'm scanning the river and I'm looking at a size as if I'm looking through a window, and then I'm moving that window template from space to space and eliminating. If I don't see something, I'll move my template. I'm also not looking for a whole fish. I'm looking for a glint. I'm looking for a tail or a flash or a color variation or any motion. The subtle telltales are what will trigger you to. And then all of a sudden the light bulb goes on. And you say, oh, well, there's the fish. But too much time is spent looking for the whole enchilada when you really should be looking for just a little piece.
Okay. We've got some kind of random questions here. David in Columbus, Ohio asks, what's the best knot to use to attach your leader to the main line? And what's the best knot to attach your tippet to the leader? I find it hard to tie a blood knot on the stream and find myself having to leave the stream to tie this knot. Is there a better one to use?
I use the nail knot to tie my fly line to my leader. I use a nail knot tool to do that. And then I use a double surgeon's loop knot to attach tippet. Just like two overhand, like you're tying your shoes twice through and spit on it, pull it tight. That'll work.
Okay. Mark in Halifax, Nova Scotia asks, does the color of your clothes and hat really make a difference to your success while fishing for trout?
You know, Charlie Myers and I differed on that. Charlie would show up in like perfectly gray, muted, camouflage-type clothes, and I'd anger him to death because I'd show up in a bright red shirt. And so I think no, Charlie says yes.
Okay.
Stealthy casting and stealthy waiting and watching your shadow is way more important than if you're wearing a bright shirt.
Yeah. Did you pull the Hawaiian shirt on him?
I did. I fish in Hawaiian shirt.
Okay, we've got... Oh, this is specific to a trip, I guess, you went on. Walton, Redding, California. He says he has also fished for golden dorado in the Bolivian jungle. Did you try any flies other than the dark colors that the guides suggest when you were there?
Yeah, I did. Rust-colored, like orangey rust, even you know, like a meat whistle type fly we caught fish on. Big trout streamers. But the rust was the other color than black that seemed to work best.
Okay. And here's one. What does CDC stand for, and is there a good reason not to use liquid floating on CDC flies?
CDC is Col de Canard, the end of the duck, and it's duck feathers, and they're highly water-resistant. You know, obviously, a duck has to be water-resistant, so you start adding goo and gels to those very fine feather fibers, and all that will cause them to do is clump up and sink, so it's kind of counterproductive. Best to leave CDC alone, and if you need to do something to help it float, use some dry shake to dry them out.
Okay. And it looks like we're just about out of time here. I'll finish up with a question from Jason Perez in Ventura, California. He says, I live in Southern California and fish mostly small, low-elevation mountain creeks. I usually buy my flies from big chain sporting goods stores, probably Chinese-made flies, or they could be Thai or a lot of places, I guess. Local boutique fishing stores have flies tied by local folks, but are terribly more expensive. I've never tied flies and probably won't start. Is there a big difference between the flies from the big chain stores compared to the more expensive mom-and-pop shops?
Well, that's a good question and kind of a difficult answer. It's one, if you answer with your head, the answer is no. I mean, I'd rather fish 10 flies well in 10 different ways than have 100 different fancy flies. You know, staple patterns like a parachute Adams and a Prince Nymph will get you a long way. And having them in a box is important. But the sentimental choice or sentimental answer is that those specialty mom-and-pop shops have always been special to me and I think are part of the fabric of the fly fishing culture. So I personally don't have a problem, you know, spending a little extra change per fly every once in a while to support the mom-and-pop shop because I think it's important that they stick around. So
yeah.
I don't think there's a right or wrong answer, and I think that the rationale for doing either is good, but
yeah.
I go both ways.
Yeah, and I think you made a good point there. I always, whenever I go fishing anywhere, I always buy, you know, a dozen flies if, you know, at the local shop, because you're in there and you're asking questions and stuff too, even if you're not using their guide service. And most shops are more than willing to help you out, and that's the least you can do is buy a dozen flies from them, you know. So
that's kind of the price of admission. It's like you buy a ticket to go to the movies. If I'm going to give you my best information, you know, if you buy a dozen flies from me and I make a few bucks, that's a good thing.
Yeah, yeah, it sure is. Well, Kirk, we're out of time, and we didn't get past page 3 of your book, I think. There's tons of more questions and tips and tricks in the book that you answer there, so people will just have to get your book if they want to search that out. So we've got to wrap things up here, but when we return, we're going to give away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine, and we'll also be giving away copy of your book, A Little Red Book on Fly Fishing, courtesy of Kirk and Skyhorse Publishing. So stay with us, folks. We'll do that in just a moment. The Bristol Bay region of southwest Alaska is home to the largest runs of wild salmon on the planet and some of the best trophy rainbow trout fishing found anywhere. The Pebble Mine still remains a threat to the region, and a 2 million acres of federal lands may be also at risk. The entire fly fishing industry has united on this epic conservation battle. Anglers from across the country are joining the fight. Be one of them. Visit www.savebristolbay.org. That's www.savebristolbay.org. And you can get more information there about how you can help out. Okay, just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd truly appreciate it. Now it's time to give away our prizes, and the winners for our drawings are randomly selected from this show's registration database. And if you haven't registered yet, it's a little too late now, but make sure you do it for our next show because we're always giving away some great prizes, and I know you'll want a chance to win those. So first thing up is the one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, and that's always a great gift to receive, a great organization to support, and a lot of good benefits by becoming a member there. And our winner for that is Scott Hood. Scott Hood, so congratulations, Scott. And for those of you that want to find out more about the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org, and you can get more information on that organization. Now, our winner for the one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine is Ted Hasselbring. Ted Hasselbring, and congratulations, Ted. I know you're going to enjoy this magazine. It's a great pictorial magazine. It's got lots of pictures and good articles on how to be a better fly fisher. So congratulations on that. So now, Kirk, we've got to give away your book. So let me think of a question here. Let me clear my queue. We've still got questions coming in here. So sorry, folks, we couldn't get to all of them. But that's why fly fishing is so much fun, is because there's always another question, another challenge around the corner to be answered. And it becomes a lifelong learning experience, that's for sure. At least it has been for me. Okay. All right. So let's see. Got to make sure, Kurt, nobody's trying to anticipate my question here. Okay. When we were talking about a beautiful day, nice sun, gin clear water, the perfect day, it might not always be the perfect day to fish, Kirk recommended somewhere to go to look for the fish there. Where would be the best place to be fishing on a river with those conditions in mind? So what do we have here? Did I ask that okay, Kirk?
Yeah, I think I know the answer.
Oh, good.
I'm hoping. I got my answer anyway.
Well, yeah, because you already answered it once, Kirk.
I hope it's the same one that it was before.
Yeah. So we got here's our first answer. He says, next to the bank.
That's pretty good.
That's close enough, huh? Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Okay, so we've got Mark Power in Halifax, Nova Scotia. So, Mark, we'll need you to send us your mailing address, and you can do that in the same text box you just answered the question in, if you'd like. And then we'll get this book off to you, The Little Red Book of Fly Fishing. I know you'll enjoy it, and I'm sure you'll learn a lot from it. So enjoy, and congratulations on winning that prize. So,
Well, Kirk, thanks so much for being on the show tonight. It was a pleasure to talk with you, and I learned a lot, and I know by reading your book I'll learn even more, and thanks for being with us.
Well, I had a blast. Thanks for having me, and hope to go fishing with you sometime.
Yeah, well, we're in the same neck of the woods here, and literally.
That's right.
And like we were talking before, if a fire doesn't get us, we'll be good to go. So, we'll have to do that sometime. Well, our next broadcast will be on November 17th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and on that show we'll be interviewing Jeff Currier, and our topic for the show will be tigerfish in Tanzania. Jeff just got back from Tanzania. And Jeff is one of those people that just loves adventure fly fishing, and he's back again at it, chasing tigerfish in Tanzania. And so listen in to learn about what his experience was in fly fishing for this exotic species. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Front Range Anglers, Flats Time Charters, and Housatonic River Outfitters for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.